sword Netherclaw in both hands. It shone with a silver-red light as she used the weapon enforcer technique of her path, the flowing sword. The beam of condensed death mudra crashed into the tip of her sword and splintered, smaller beams breaking off and scouring the walls. Any living thing would be annihilated by that striker technique, but the stones were not only enforced with authority, but they were also stones. The death mudra was harmless. Yeren's lock of red hair whipped in the wind caused by the clash between their techniques, but she didn't take a step backwards. She pushed forward a step, shoving against the enemy technique. When the beam of death faded, Yeren pulled her sword back.
"See how you like it," she muttered,
and she responded in kind. A gleaming beam of red-white light shot down the tunnel, lighting everything crimson. Her focused will to destroy pushed against Linden's mind, and he suspected Orthos and Little Blue wouldn't have been able to stand this close to the technique without his protection. From the other end of the tunnel, they heard a monstrous scream.
"Wonder what that was," Ethan said brightly.
It took them 2 seconds to clear the long tunnel. The tomb hydra waited at the end of the hall in a room that reminded Linden of a honeycomb. It was spherical, like many of the other rooms they had encountered so far, but this time virtually every stretch of wall was filled with tunnel after tunnel. You could barely see any wall between all the doors heading in every direction, and many of those were hidden behind the hydra's massive body. It was a wall of gray-green scales that wrapped around the entire room, dwarfing them many times over. Its eyes blazed like lanterns of pale, deadly green. All 6 of them. One of the tomb hydra's 3 heads roared at Yeren, clearly enraged by the bloody cut her technique had gouged in its jaw. The other 2 spread out, leaning their necks around to get a better vantage point on the rest of the party. But no one was waiting around for that to happen. Black flame roared from Linden's hand, empowered with soul fire. A hail of violet arrows erupted from Mercy's bow. Orthos breathed flame, Aethon called stars down on each of the Hydra's heads, and Zeal's body began to shine bright emerald as he picked up his hammer. The Hydra sent out a wave of death mudra, but it still screamed from 3 throats as the barrage of techniques tore its body apart. Not as much as it should have been torn apart, though. Linden's black flame didn't carve the Hydra down to the bone or melt through its scales, but rather scorched it like a superficial burn. Yeren's endless sword left deep grooves spraying blood, but didn't sever a head. Mercy's arrows stuck in the scales and did nothing. Aethon's stars passed into the Hydra's spirit, but didn't come out the other side, indicating they hadn't speared through it. And in the same instant, its body uncoiled. It whipped at them, a wall of scales and muscle, forcing them all to take to the air. One head shot toward Linden and Mercy, one snapped at Zeal and Yeren, and the 3rd lunged at Aethon. At the same time, and at the worst possible moment, webs of hunger mudra shot out of the tunnels from every direction. There was a distinct will behind these attacks, and Linden knew they had finally caught Subject One's attention. Suspended in midair, with no aura to push against, Linden felt the pangs of panic. If he had been drawing from his pure core, he would have had a better defense, but he was already channeling black flame to attack the Hydra. The burning cloak appeared around him, and he dodged most of the threads. One landed against his hip with a burning sensation, and he lost a little energy to it before he twisted to break it. Then Little Blue screamed in his ear like a shattering bell. One of the strands had touched her. And that was the moment when Linden took the enemy seriously. He dropped black flame and switched to the path of twin stars. Little Blue cleansed her own channels at the same time, snapping the thread, but she was already weaker. He surrounded himself with a hollow armor, letting the death mudra wash over him and landed on the body of the snake. Then he slammed his palm down on its scales. An instant later, a forged hand bigger than his body followed the motion of his own palm. Pure mudra coursed into the hydra, and the light in its 6 eyes flickered. The others exploded with their own techniques, and Linden switched back to black flame. He drove a beam of black dragon's breath up through one of the snake's heads. Yeren sliced off a 2nd as Zeal crushed a 3rd, and then the room was filled with the hiss of rising essence and a tide of death aura. Linden grabbed Little Blue, checking with his eyes and spirit to make sure she was all right. She didn't protest in his grip, instead sagging into his hand and whistling relief. She had been weakened, substantially, but her contact with his Madra was restoring her strength.
"Ethan, you and I handle the remnant,"
Lendon called. His pure Madra cycled faster. Ethan was peering in the direction of the Hydra's body.
"No need. It's a dread beast."
Lendon looked at the creature, unconvinced.
"Pardon, but it doesn't look like one."
Even the dread gods, at least the ones he'd seen, didn't look like sacred beasts that could occur in the real world. The phoenix was made up of liquid blood Madra, and the titan looked to be made of stone. The lesser dread beasts, even those with the power of lords, had all looked like creatures from a horror story. They were twisted and mutated bodies, broken from the inside out.
"Look for yourself," Ethan suggested.
He gestured to the oozing neck stump. Lyndon placed his foot on the edge of the snake's head, which was bigger than he was, and shoved it aside. Sure enough, lines burned with the pale spectral green of death Madra running in veins all through the Hydra's flesh.
"This is..."
Lyndon had dissected his share of dread beasts, and it was hard to put into words how shocked he was by this sight.
"It's so organized. This looks like a real set of Madra channels. And how can death Madra, of all things, possibly exist alongside real living flesh?"
Yaren was peering into the severed neck as well. He suspected that she was doing the same thing he was, and blocking off her sense of smell.
"You think this is what the dread gods look like inside?"
Yaren asked. Lyndon remembered a vision Suriel had shown him, not so long ago. A white tiger the size of a house, strung up and splayed open so that he could separate its spirit from its body surgically. Its spirit had been every bit as intricate as its flesh, with the two layered over and into one another, so it was difficult to tell where one ended and the other began.
"We need to find out."
Before Mercy could protest, he continued.
"I know we don't have as much time as we'd like, but this could end up being the most valuable thing we find down here. It's a chance to study a small dread god. If we come out with nothing else, this could be invaluable."
"I agree," Frost said. "Master Northstrider's subordinates gathered and studied many dread beasts to better understand the relationship between the body and the spirit. They would have been grateful for this opportunity."
Mercy leaned on her staff, shifting her weight anxiously. She glanced at the ceiling as though she might see her mother's hand descending on them at any second.
"I understand, I really do, but please, hurry."
Lyndon triggered his void key. It didn't open. He frowned at it, pulling the bronze key from the thread around his neck and sensing the script. It seemed to be fully intact. He triggered it again. This time, light slowly zipped open, revealing the entrance to his void space.
"Ethan?"
Lyndon said.
"I saw it. Clearly spatial manipulation is restricted here. I suppose it's to keep certain beings from escaping. Well, that prevents us from easily hiding in a void key."
Lyndon glanced to Little Blue. He had considered sending her and Orthos back into the Dawn Sky Palace to avoid the dangers here, now that it was clear that he couldn't fully protect them. If there was a chance for them to get trapped inside, that option was no longer available. But they were still on a time limit, and Lyndon had work to do. He climbed into his void key, fishing around for his soulsmithing tools. He withdrew a pair of gold steel-plated tongs and a knife, though after a moment of thought he pocketed the knife. He blanketed the tomb Hydra's body in his spiritual perception, tracing the Madra system that nested parasitically within its body.
"Dross, would you locate the binding for me?"
"Of course."
"Yaren, can you open up the body? From here to about there, and I would be grateful if you could leave the Madra intact."
Yaren tapped the hilt of her sword with a finger, and the flesh slid away from the dread beast's body. It released a cloud of steam, and most likely a putrid stench. Lyndon didn't know, because his nose was still sealed off. The shining veins of spectral green Madra began to release essence, but they were clear and unbroken. Lyndon readied his tongs only a moment before Dross said,
"Binding located."
A purple light shone about a foot deep in the center of the Hydra's body. Lyndon resonated his soul fire and reached out to the blood aura, which hadn't yet been sifted away by the labyrinth's hunger. With the blood aura, he pulled the flesh apart and revealed the binding. It grew from the meat around it, reminding him at the same time of a ripe fruit and a pulsing heart. It was condensed from the power of death, a pale green fire that pumped power into the rest of the body instead of blood. He seized it with the gold steel tongs, pointing out to Yaren where he needed incisions, but his instinct said the binding was somewhat strange. It looked more like an enforcer binding, though the dreadbeast's breath must have been a striker technique. Striker techniques were usually elongated, with a clear input and output. Striker bindings this round were rare. Still, he withdrew it and quickly placed it into a script-sealed box. Valuable materials were not to be wasted. Any more bindings, Dross?
None.
That was also odd. Sometimes bindings didn't survive the transformation into a remnant, so you couldn't always recover every technique the sacred artist had engraved into their spirit in life, but the dreadbeast's spirit hadn't become a remnant. Surely it had more than one technique. Linden peeled away some veins of death mudra as well. He wasn't about to pass up free dead matter, but that wasn't nearly as valuable as the binding. He only spent a few minutes stripping those lines out and coiling them into the box with the binding before he slammed it shut and slid it back into his void key.
That's an advanced binding, Zeal observed. What are you going to make with it?
I'll have to see what it does first, Linden responded. But it was always going to become some kind of weapon. There weren't too many other uses for death mantra.
He supposed it should have a hunger aspect, too. He hadn't sensed it, but then again, he hadn't activated the binding. And sensing hunger mantra here was like trying to sense water aura in the depths of the ocean. Now that he'd gotten what he was going to get out of the dreadbeast's corpse, it was safe to use the hand again. He struggled with the awareness of the labyrinth the hand's authority granted him, trying to unravel it into a map in his mind as the hand itself struggled against him. It shook his concentration and fought against him physically, practically dragging him down a tunnel before he figured out where they needed to go. And then he wrestled it to a stop, because the hand was trying to pull him in two directions at once. It sprang to his left, but when he approached the tunnel on his left, it would suddenly lunge to the opening on his right. It repeated that several times until some hungry ghouls clawed their way through the stone and the others eradicated them. He had to tuck the hand away so it didn't keep calling hostile attention.
It looks like we have a choice, Linden said.
On the left, the tunnel was marked with a hammer, the forger symbol from the Sacred Valley badges. On the right, it bore the scythe symbol, the crest of the Aurelius founder, of Azrael. The map had given him the layout and a sense into the structure and pattern of the labyrinth itself, but very little into what the rooms contained. That was what the symbols were for, and given the choice between an ordinary soulsmith room and one left behind by Azrael, the conclusion was clear.
Easy decision, Linden said, as he led the way into the tunnel.
Aethon followed him immediately, but Yaren was stopped by a thrown hand from Zeal.
Hang on, he said.
The tunnel entrance vanished, leaving Linden and Aethon locked inside. The scripted lights on the ceiling still cast dim illumination over them, but Linden added to it with his black dragon's breath. It did absolutely nothing, which he had expected. He could sense the authority hanging over this whole place. It was inviolable. Linden drew up his will and prepared to challenge that. Aethon rested a hand on his shoulder, but he wasn't watching Linden. He was looking up and around him, tracing his bloodline power.
I can't see through the walls here, he said, but there's a way around. They'll stay in place. We can loop around and find them.
Hurry, Linden said, setting off down the tunnel. I don't like our odds in here with just us.
Little Blue burbled a reminder in his ear.
I was counting you, he protested.
You weren't counting me, Dross said.
That was true.
Ah, four and four, Aethon said. We've been divided in half. What a fortuitous coincidence.
Linden thought about the living techniques that had tracked them. He looked to the walls, with the authority on them, which required living intention to maintain. Someone was controlling this place. Subject one. The soul cloak sprung up around him.
Keep up, he said shortly.
Then he dashed into the darkness. Yeren lowered her weapon as the air still crackled from her final sword, or at least the version of it she could use in here. The stone wall was unscratched. This was the downside of Blood Mandra. If it didn't have blood, she had a harder time cutting it. Mercy dropped into a crouch, holding her head.
Okay, deep breaths. They'll come back for us.
If they can, Zeal said. He glanced around to the few remaining exits. Instead of being full of uncountable tunnels, the room was now mostly bare. Orthos was pacing impatiently back and forth, but he still shot a red and black glare at Zeal.
We have nothing to guide us forward. We should wait here.
Yeren held Netherclaw loosely in her right hand and glanced around. She had a bad feeling about this. The labyrinth wasn't shifting at random, she was certain. There was a will behind it. And while she had nothing to lean on but her intuition, she felt like it wasn't watching Linden at the moment. It was watching them.
Stay sharp, Yeren said.
Swords up!
Mercy had her bow drawn and arrow nocked before Yeren finished the first word. Her back was to the group, and she scanned the darkness.
Did you sense something? The body's still here.
Yeren couldn't feel any hunger Madra coming, but trying to sense hunger down here was blinding. She just knew that something was on its way. Zeal started scraping runes and the tomb Hydra's blood, which covered much of the floor. Not a bad idea. Might as well build up some defenses, even if they wouldn't last long. Yeren's spirit screamed a warning, and she activated the endless sword. Half a dozen hungry ghouls that had been rising from the floor fell apart, but the aura was too weak here. Some living techniques survived, and there were dozens more. They flooded up around the dread beast's body, forcing the sacred artists to fall back. As they rose, the ghouls shredded the Hydra. They opened their wide mouths and took chunks out of its meat, devouring Madra, aura, and flesh alike.
I saw some swordfish feed in a river once, Orthos said in solemn tones. They stripped a bird the size of a house down to its bones in seconds.
Do swordfish live in rivers? Mercy asked.
Not swordfish, swordfish. Their teeth are swords.
We should back up, Zeal pointed out. The hunger techniques did their work in seconds, and they did more than just strip the corpse down to bones. Even the bones were devoured, reduced to nothing, leaving a swarm of pale ghouls made of Madra scurrying over the spot where the beast had been, like ants after a feast. The others retreated, but Yeren didn't. She stood only a few strides from the hunger techniques. She was feeling weak after that final sword, and even the endless sword had stretched her since she was using it in such an aura-dry environment. She knew exactly what it meant to spend more power here. But something was watching her. A silver-red glow shone around her blade as she activated the flowing sword. She only had traces of aura to complement the Madra, so the technique wasn't stable, but it was stable enough. She struck each ghoul with her Madra-clad sword, dispersing them to clouds of Madra. It took her less than a second. Puffs of death Madra and aura of every kind leaked into the air as the ghouls died. They had fed, but hadn't had the chance to return to their source yet. In that way, they were like the bloodspawn of the bleeding phoenix. She didn't like that comparison. Yeren glanced down at the floor.
We're not backing down.
She doubted it could hear her, but it was her actions that should send the message. When she didn't get a response, she turned back to the others.
Huddle up and get our backs to a wall. If we don't get hit again soon, I'll dance a little jig.
I would be interested to see that, Orthos said.
Zeal frowned into the distance.
You think it will keep sending the spirits after us?
No, but if there's no way for a giant dreadbeast to stay alive down here, that means it came from somewhere else. They'll make another one. There's no telling how long that will take, Mercy pointed out. Maybe it takes days, and this could be the last one. They can't have bred too many. If that's true, you'll get to see my jig, but...
The walls blurred right on cue, once again making Yeren wonder what the controller of the labyrinth could see. Now, only one opening remained, on the ceiling. And another tomb hydra dropped from the ceiling.
I'm not much of a dancer.
By the time Ethan shouted for Lyndon to stop, Lyndon had already slammed to a halt. His instincts had warned him just in time, even before Ethan's superior detection could keep up. But it had been close. A script activated right in front of Lyndon's eyes, sending a line of what looked like black glass sliding up ahead of his nose. Destruction mantra. Ethan gave an exaggerated sigh when he caught up.
I'm not sure that would have been tough enough to break you, but I don't want to be performing emergency medical aid here in an ancient tomb at the heart of the world.
Lyndon caught his breath and stilled his beating heart as he examined the script. Dross, what do you think about this?
I think it's a good thing you weren't a little faster. Ha ha.
Lyndon winced.
This is a security measure against intruders. I find it strange that we have not seen more such scripts thus far.
We'll have to slow down, Lyndon said, but he was excited by the trap's presence. Ethan noticed.
I see you're thinking what I'm thinking.
The other intruder would have broken this. If we're the first people here in centuries, there might be something left. And any hint left behind by Osriel could be a treasure.
We don't want to make our friends wait too long.
Oh, of course not.
But where there's one trap, there could be others. We should move cautiously.
It's only wise.
Little Blue's voice rang with her impatience. Passing the scripted trap was easy once they knew it was there, and there were indeed more traps afterwards. They were all lethal. Lyndon had expected more illusions or clouds, but he was met entirely with razor-sharp blades or focused beams of heat. In other words, Lyndon and Ethan strolled through.
How do constructs stay powered around so much hunger? Lyndon asked.
The aura here should feed on anything indiscriminately, not even counting the living hunger techniques that traveled around consuming whatever they found.
They're protected, Ethan said. Which is fascinating, since anything from the Aurelius founder should predate the introduction of Hunger Madra to this labyrinth. Did he anticipate this, or was he protecting against other threats? A puzzle for you.
Pardon, but surely your guess would be better than mine. Ethan was quiet for a moment as they both dodged a spray of venomous darts.
Making my own guess would be less than productive. Why don't you see if you can guess the thoughts of a genius soulsmith? Might be good for you.
That didn't make much sense to Lyndon, but if Ethan wasn't willing to speculate, Lyndon wasn't going to make him. Especially since they'd made it to the end of the hallway. The room was less than Lyndon had expected from a secret chamber hidden by a powerful expert at the heart of a deadly labyrinth. It was more like a cramped bedroom than a huge soulsmith foundry, though there was no bed. There were instead wooden tables crammed against the walls, each carrying piles of... Lyndon didn't want to call the objects random junk, because there had to be more to them than met the eye. But he saw a pearl necklace tossed carelessly on top of a pile of mismatched silk scarves. A quiver full of arrows leaned against a set of 15 books with titles Lyndon couldn't read. There were 8 tables in the room, each with a similar pile, and not one of the objects held any obvious spiritual power, at least none that remained. But there were a few spots of dream mudra here and there, and the sources were obvious. Tiny crystals had been tied to each object, and Lyndon ran his spiritual sense into one such dream tablet.
A stately woman wears the necklace of pearls as she addresses her army. She raises a hand to direct them, and the scene shifts. She comes onto the deck of a cloud ship, and rays of golden light form around her hands. The scene shifts again. With an icy look on her face, she orders the execution of a sobbing woman who looks just like her. Grief hangs over the scene like a cloud.
Abruptly, the memory cut off. Lyndon was shaken. Compared to most of the other tablets he'd viewed, this one was more chaotic and less complete, and it wasn't entirely clear whose memory it was. It felt almost like a composite of memories from someone else with the noble woman's emotions layered over them. But it was clear that this woman, whose name he hadn't caught, had been the owner of the necklace. It had been important to her. Lyndon had felt that. She was known for always wearing this necklace, and it had become one of her signatures. Linden quickly relayed what he'd seen to Ethan, who nodded. He looked unsurprised, but he also didn't seem to be examining the objects himself. Then again, he could be scrutinizing everything in the room at once without moving an inch. Linden checked another one, a signet ring bearing the image of a winged ship. This one belonged to a water artist who fought across the seas, attempting to create safe paths for humans through sacred beast territory. He lent this ring to his subordinates, and anyone who carried it could speak for him. From the ring, Linden finally sensed something. It was subtle, but heavy, slightly more real than the objects around it. It reminded him of his sage's command. The word carrying authority felt heavier than the others. Now that he knew what to look for, he sharpened his senses and scanned the other objects on the table. Some of their dream tablets had faded with time, and from most of the objects themselves, he felt nothing. But a handful gave him a positive feeling, so he separated them into a pile. A quiver of arrows, the ring, a blue silk scarf, and a bronze buckler carved with the image of a chariot in battle. Only these four gave him any sense that they could be worth anything, but it was difficult to be certain. "Did you find anything?" he asked Ethan. Ethan was holding a small dagger, smiling sadly at it as the dream tablet flickered. Its memory must be tragic. "My sense for these things is not as developed as yours," he said. "So you know what's special about these?" Linden had wondered as much, with Ethan being Ethan. "Just as certain people can exert greater force on reality than others, so too can certain objects," Ethan said quietly. "They are significant because of what, or more commonly, whom, they represent." He tossed the dagger back down, as though it were worthless. "It seems that this room is where someone, presumably my patriarch, kept objects that he suspected might become significant. Most of them failed the test." Linden looked eagerly at the four objects he'd separated. "So these are powerful?" "They can be. This is the highest level of soulsmithing, and it must be approached with care. The price of success can be higher than the price of failure." Little Blue tugged at Linden's hair, pointing toward the room's one exit, but Linden couldn't let Ethan's remark pass. "Where did you learn this, Ethan?" Ethan looked deeply into Linden's eyes, searching for something. Then he pulled out a marble, inside which a hole in the world hung suspended. "As I've told you, I became the advisor to the monarch Tiberian Aurelius very early in my advancement." Ethan had shared several stories from that time in his life over the last few months, and Linden had hung on to each one. They felt like glimpses into a mystery. "I have always had a knack for understanding the records of my predecessors. Not just dream tablets, but their writings. There were patterns that I picked up on that very few have ever put together." He thought for a moment, seeming to choose his words carefully. "I believed that I could advance my family and perhaps the world by revealing these truths, and one such truth I revealed was this." He held up Osriel's marble. "His records were hidden among my family for hundreds of generations, and if you know how to read them, they contained insight applicable to more than soulsmithing. They locked this away and worshipped it instead of following the path it outlined. Of course, there have been members of my family who have ascended. In the grand scheme of things, it isn't terribly unusual to ascend beyond this world. But none of them picked up the banner he tried to pass them. With Tiberian, I thought we had a chance. And then, against my advice, he approached the other monarch on the continent." Linden's stomach dropped. "You're not saying his name?" Ethan looked into the darkness. No, I'm not. There are only a few people who could navigate the labyrinth besides us. And perhaps now we are trapped in here with a monarch. Or perhaps he is trapped here with us." Chapter 12 Yeren sent a wave of razor-sharp madra at the tomb hydra while it was still falling from the hole in the ceiling. Zeal conjured a barrier of force around himself, lifting his hammer. Mercy had already released a barrage of arrows, and Orthos breathed out a bar of black dragon's breath that was now bigger than his entire head. The concentrated wave of Death Madra wiped out most of their attacks in an instant. Only Yeren's rippling sword was dense enough to cut through the Hydra's Madra, and it half-severed the creature's rightmost head. But she had to dash to the side and intercept the rest of the Death Madra, diverting enough of the deadly energy with her sword to protect the others, or at least Orthos and Mercy. She suspected Zeal would be fine. The remaining Madra from the Striker technique washed over the semi-transparent barrier generated by Zeal's script, and then the Tomb Hydra landed with an impact that shook the entire room. Both heads, with their shining green eyes, lunged at Yeren, which was how she wanted it. She extended her sword arms and planted her feet, focusing her will. She would not be moved. The teeth of the first head crashed around her, and her sword arms caught them. She flexed, forcing the jaws apart. The second head simply rammed into her from the other side, surrounded by a ring of Death Madra that would burn away her lifeline. She met that with her sword, which shone with her own Madra. By all rights, the impact alone should have torn her to shreds or pulverized her insides. But instead of popping like a swatted mosquito, she stood her ground. The Hydra heads reacted like they'd run into a rock. The first head's teeth began to crack, and the second head slammed into her sword and then lurched back, dazed. Yeren may not have advanced to Archlord yet, but she hadn't spent the last month sitting on her hands. Her will was steel. She slashed down with her gold signs and up with Netherclaw. Blood sprayed both the floor and the ceiling. The Tomb Hydra retreated, hissing furiously, but only one of its heads remained alive. It was dragging the other two along as dead weight. Even that remaining head was torn half off, revealing bone and a few glowing veins of raw Madra. Yeren understood she wasn't getting back the Madra she'd spent here, especially if she didn't meet up with Linden soon. She had a few elixirs remaining, but she never carried most of them. Why would she? Linden carried enough supplies to start a business as a refiner and a soulsmith both. But she was still feeling sunny about her odds. Whatever it cost the labyrinth to make or summon or breed these huge dread beasts, they couldn't be free either. Her mood cracked like an egg when she saw the walls blur again and a huge tunnel opened up on their left. A second massive Tomb Hydra slithered out, hauling death. Now fear crept up on her. Not for herself, but for the others. If only one person made it out of here, it was likely to be her. Three mouths opened, shining with Death Madra, and Yeren stopped holding back. Her moonlight bridge wrapped her in white light, carrying her to her destination, on top of the Tomb Hydra. Madra awakened Netherclaw, and it summoned the Forger technique for which it had been named. A massive beast claw formed over her head, constructed strand by strand from bloody Madra. It carried her power alongside its own, and the Archlord technique cut down at the Tomb Hydra. It twisted in place, clashing with its power against her sword, but Yeren wasn't waiting around. As soon as she'd used the binding in the sword, she spun and slammed her fist down on the Hydra's scales with all her strength. All her strength. The chamber rang louder than it had when the monster hit the ground. The force of her punch pulverized bones and twisted space. Air tore away from her like a hurricane, and tiny cracks crawled out across the ground in a web. The snake spasmed, its midsection crushed, and the Netherclaw slashed without resistance. All three heads were torn off in one swipe. Yeren leaped off the body, sword in hand. The other snake was still alive, and she had to protect the others. From midair, she saw the others finish off the first Hydra. The head of Zeal's hammer, powered by a circle of green runes, slammed it into the floor. Yeren let herself land gently. She burned the gore from her sword with blood Madra and nodded in respect to Zeal.
Nice hit.
He looked as though he didn't believe her. At first, she thought that was just him being unfriendly, but Mercy was staring at her too.
Yeren?
Mercy said hesitantly.
I think I might head back once we meet up with the others.
Yeren forced open her own void key, which seemed to want to stick, and rummaged around until she found one of her few elixirs. This one had been made just for her, as the bottle contained a medicine that specialized in restoring blood and sword Madra, but she grimaced as she drank it. It was gritty and tasted like steel and charcoal. Yeren wiped her mouth, mostly to buy time to think about her response.
Not a bad idea. It'd be safer inside a dragon's mouth than down here. But you knew that when you came down.
Ortho snorted smoke and nibbled at the dread beast's body.
We thought there would be something we could do.
Mercy fiddled with black-gloved fingers.
Dread beasts like this, to us, one would be a deadly fight. But for you, they're not worth mentioning. I'm not sure what we can do other than get in the way.
Yeren felt hunger spirits rising around the corpse, and she saw the chance to make a point. She hopped up on top of the dead Hydra and looked down on the others. Then she cycled a little Madra to her eyes so they would glow red, for effect.
We've been friends for a long stretch now, Yeren said. You think I'd rather be down here alone?
White ghouls began crawling up from the ground, and she released her spiritual pressure. Yeren glared at the nearest ghoul.
Mine, she said.
She was no sage, but she suspected it would get the point. Now, there were two possibilities, and either would suit her purpose. Either these mindless techniques would ignore her warning and head for her, in which case she would crush them and show off a bit, or they would go for easier prey. The hollow-eyed ghouls slid away from Yeren even as they bubbled up from below, lurching after the others with surprising speed. Yeren cycled her Madra to her steel-born iron body and braced herself. Then she dashed all over the room in a blur of speed. It cost her very little Madra. Even here, with the hunger aura grinding away her spirit a little at a time, she could keep this up all day. She sheathed her sword, and severed limbs of animated hunger Madra dissolved to essence.
You'll catch up, Yeren said confidently. And until you do, what's so bad about letting me carry you?
Orthos burned so clearly with the resolve to improve himself that Yeren could practically see it. Mercy's eyes welled up, and even Zeal gripped his hammer a little harder. Yeren felt a smile tug at the corner of her mouth. Not only did she have friends along, but she was in a position where she could protect them. Ruby would be just as happy as Yeren was. Linden paced outside the chamber, waiting as the storm of deadly blades raged. Athan had clearly indicated this was the way through, but it seemed this room was designed solely to slow them down. When they approached, they had triggered a script that activated constructs all throughout the room. Swords of Madra, clouds of corrosive aura, and needles of blood rampaged through the room in a deadly storm. Athan and Linden could wade through the room untouched, and Linden had wanted to do that, but Athan had stopped him. They'd already wasted quite a bit of Madra, and the only way to get through was for them to spend more. Instead, Athan suggested they simply wait. The room's constructs would run out of power before they ran out of time. Linden was impatient. Who knew when the route back would shift?
We need to get back, he insisted. As far as we know, there might never be a way back again.
That would be unlikely, Dross said, and Athan nodded in agreement. There's obviously some kind of intelligence running this place, Athan said. But it can't keep us separated forever. There must be certain patterns, or it could lock all intruders in a room and remove the exits.
Apologies, but that's weak logic to hang all of our lives on.
Athan shrugged.
If I'm wrong, then you burn through the walls. With a void icon and black flame, it should be possible.
Linden nodded. He wanted to do it now, but that would exhaust him, and he'd be useless for the rest of the trip, or at least for a while. Little Blue whispered comfort to him, and Linden decided to distract himself with another project.
Dross, can you simulate a soulsmithing project?
Somewhat. My capabilities are not what they were, but as long as we can rely on known information, I should be able to replicate a simple project successfully.
Once again, Linden missed the real Dross. At his request, the binding from the Tomb Hydra appeared in front of him, floating in the air. It shone with the pale spectral green of Death Madra and looked roughly like a human heart the size of a head. There were several entrances, which resembled broken arteries. Linden ran pure Madra through one, and a weak beam of death emanated from the other end of the binding. Curious, he moved his pure madra through the other one. This time, a haze of death madra appeared around the heart. A lethal field that, if it were real, would have eaten away at his lifeline and begun corroding his flesh.
Is this accurate? Lyndon asked.
As much as it can be without testing. The intensity of the effect, its response to pure madra, and its activation time are all suppositions on my part.
But this is really several techniques.
Yes.
That was intriguing. Potentially revolutionary. Bindings were crystallized techniques, meaning they were each one technique. Sometimes soulsmiths could blend one into the other, but it always created a hybrid technique. It never layered the two techniques on top of one another. If you wanted the techniques to be used together, or in sequence, you had to design your construct to allow it. Usually, that was done with scripts. But this dread beast had only one binding for several techniques, as though its bindings had all organically fused into one. Lyndon fueled the third of the four openings, and a forged set of jaws appeared, its teeth shining green. It snapped down on nothing, and now Lyndon finally felt the hunger component of the binding coming to the forefront. This was how the Hydra fed. Ethan cleared his throat.
I hate to complain, but it's pretty boring sitting here watching you hold on to nothing.
Lyndon remembered that he must look ridiculous, interacting with thin air. Dross, can you project to Ethan?
I can, but that will cost me valuable madra.
Lyndon hesitated. He was doubly reluctant to exhaust Dross after what had happened the last time the spirit strained himself.
Very well, then, leave me out, Ethan said. I will infer from your conversation what you have been doing. Are you testing out the Hydra's binding?
It's amazing, like four bindings grown into one. I've seen dreadbeasts with bindings that had melted into one another, but they never worked well. They always felt like a failure, but this could be the perfected version.
He activated the fourth binding, but nothing happened. He sensed it had been reaching out to the surrounding aura, but there was no death aura nearby, so the ruler technique hadn't activated. Ethan tapped his fingers together.
Disturbing implications, but that was always one of the strongest theories about the origins of the dreadbeasts, that they were the failures, and the successes were the dread gods.
Lyndon examined the binding, turning it in his hands.
So you're saying the dread gods have a binding like this one?
You'd have to kill one to prove it, but I would say it's likely.
Lyndon ran his perception through the room ahead. The constructs were starting to slow down, but he still had time. He could take a closer look at the actual binding. It would help him later, and Dross couldn't model it accurately unless Lyndon studied it. Ethan slowly slid into his line of sight. He was massaging his temples with both hands.
Let me see if I can divine your thoughts. You are tempted to examine the actual binding, but you are hesitant to do so, and what's this? Please, I know you admire my keen insight, but don't let those thoughts distract you. Focus.
This might be my only chance at this. I don't want to waste it.
A mistake soulsmithing could damage the binding beyond repair. If Dross learned enough to be able to replicate the binding, then that was fine, but he still didn't want to lose such a valuable material.
There should be better facilities somewhere here, Lyndon went on. I want to see the effect of the location myself, and if the hammer's as important as you say it is, I want one of those too.
Ethan cuffed a hand around his ear.
I need to hear you say it. I need to hear you say the words.
Lyndon was lost.
Say, please, Ethan, solve this problem for me.
It's not a problem, really. I could examine it now, but I think it's better to wait until later.
Okay, then, say, if only I had a place to practice soulsmithing right here.
That would be convenient, but I'm not really looking to make a construct.
Please say it.
If I only had a place...
Worry no more, my student. With my incredible foresight, I have solved your problem long ago.
With a flourish, Ethan produced a tiny object shaped like an anvil. Lyndon could immediately sense that it was a void key, or something similar. Ethan practically forced it into his hand, so Lyndon ran his madra through it. He had to join his will to it and push through a faint resistance. Either the labyrinth's suppression of spatial artifacts was increasing, or he was getting tired. A moment later, a door opened in midair. It led onto a space that was much stranger than most void keys Lyndon had seen. a platform of stones hovered in the middle of an endless starry sky. Each of the stars were larger and clearer than usual, shining brightly from every direction. The stones themselves were large wedges that fit together into a circle about the size of a small room. Each wedge held a symbol that... Lyndon had to look away from the symbols because of a piercing pain in his head. They formed a script, he was sure, but they reminded him more of the runes in Suriel's eyes. There was meaning there that he couldn't pierce. At the center of the platform of interlocking stones, there was a slab of dull metal. It resembled an altar more than an anvil, or perhaps half of a column. Inside that altar, a blue flame burned, visible through a small window, so perhaps it was more like a stove. Lyndon drew Suriel's marble from his pocket and compared. As he'd suspected, the blue fire in his marble was eerily similar to the one blazing within the altar, except the one here was many times bigger.
"Lyndon, allow me to introduce you to the ultimate soul-smithing tool, the Soul Forge."
Lyndon reverently held his breath as he walked inside. He felt the world around him change as he stepped inside in ways more than the physical. Echoes of creation filled the air. This was a place where wonders were born. He paced around the anvil at the center, examining the stones, the flame, even the stars in the distance. "How does it work?" he asked. Ethan beamed.
"Why don't you tell me?"
Lyndon still couldn't examine the huge paving stones beneath his feet too closely, because the single rune carved on each of them was too overwhelming, but it was clear that the script circle was focused on the anvil at the center. And the anvil, if that's what it was clearly the focus of all the creative energies in this space. In a mundane forge, you would heat up metal in the flame to make it malleable enough to shape, but that didn't have much relevance to soulsmithing. He approached the center and felt the energy gathered above the altar-like anvil. There was little to see, but the air felt invisibly focused there, charged, as though waiting for something.
"I think anything you put there is altered, enhanced, maybe."
He knelt to look at the blue fire.
"This fuels the effect somehow. I assume you have to burn something here? Soul fire."
Ethan was about to answer, but Lyndon cut him off as an idea occurred to him.
"No, wait."
He pulled out the pearl necklace he had found earlier. From Ethan's proud smile, Lyndon already knew he was right, but he tossed the necklace in anyway. The physical form of the necklace burned to ash in an instant, which dissolved to nothing with a hiss, but the flame strengthened. Just to test it out, he tossed in some junk with no authority whatsoever. It burned up, but the flame didn't change. Lyndon moved to his feet, full of confidence.
"It takes objects with embedded authority and burns them, focusing in on whatever you're making above the altar."
Ethan applauded.
"Very good. We say objects with invested authority or willpower are significant, but the terminology changes from place to place, so it's not important. You're so right, it brings a tear to my eye."
"But what does it do to the soulsmithing?"
"In traditional soulsmithing, Archlord artifacts are effectively the peak. There is no higher form of soulfire than that which Archlords produce, and spirits are usually raised past that stage artificially. Being stronger than Archlords don't often die and leave remnants, you see. Even if you were fortunate enough to get a herald or monarch's remnant, or to raise a remnant to be equivalent to a herald, you would still be tempering it in Archlord soulfire. It would be only marginally better than an actual Archlord weapon."
Ethan swept his arms around the Soul Forge.
"If you really want to perform soulsmithing on a higher level, you need a way to imbue the authority and willpower of a greater existence into the item. That requires tools and locations on a superior tier of existence, which are few and far between. If you wanted to forge a monarch, a sword, for instance, you would want to do it on a battlefield in which monarchs died, of which there are surpassingly few. This was a fairly ingenious solution, I will admit. A portable location that can increase the level of existence of projects worked here, allowing the manipulation of more advanced forces. It's not quite as good as if you crafted a device in a significant location that suited the project, but it has the advantage of being universally compatible and mobile."
Lyndon wanted to rub his cheek all over the anvil.
He could see exactly how much of an advantage this would be. But Ethan had used a word that caught his attention.
Did you have a hand in the creation of this soul forge, Ethan?
The Archlord sighed. Sadly, not. This was Rhaegon Shen's design and creation, and he was only willing to part with it because he is capable of building another one, though it will be expensive, even for him. Something visibly occurred to Ethan, and he asked, Why did you ask if I made it?
You called it ingenious.
Ethan staggered back, clapping a finger to his chest as though wounded. I do not like what you're implying, my beloved disciple. So this was part of Rhaegon Shen's bribe.
Lyndon looked around the space, jealousy worming its way through his heart.
Why didn't you show me this before? Are you even a soulsmith?
It's rare to find a sacred artist who hasn't at least dabbled in soulsmithing, Ethan protested. And it so happens that I have been using this facility to prepare the materials for the pure storm baptism that Zeal has enjoyed. I intended to pass this on to you when you were ready, and now that we have been interacting with objects of some significance...
He left the sentence hanging suggestively, and Lyndon was so excited by the space that he was willing to let it pass that Ethan had kept another secret from them.
Does this mean you can make anything? Wait, just a second. Did you say you were passing it on to me?
Very soon. Zeal could still use one more treatment, I'd say, but it's best that you start practicing before you inherit this from me.
Can we use this to fix Dross?
Ethan cleared his throat.
If it could, I would have revealed it to you earlier. I'm sorry, but you will find a solution for Dross, I'm certain.
Lyndon was overwhelmed. He blinked back tears.
It's too much, Lyndon said,
though he would already fight a Dreadgod with half a paintbrush over the Soul Forge.
You've given me so much already.
Ethan cocked his head as though he didn't understand.
I consider the things I've given you to be the best investments I've ever made.
Lyndon straightened up and pressed his fists together, bowing over them in a sincere salute.
Gratitude, Master.
You know, you never call me that.
Ethan ushered Lyndon out of the Soul Forge, though Lyndon kept shooting longing glances backwards.
It's probably for the best. I don't want status to go to my head.
I'm not sure I can pay back an investment like this.
Oh, you can start paying me back once we're out of Cradle. My investments are long-term.
Information restricted. Personal record 3349. Authorization required to access. Authorization confirmed. 008. Osriel. Beginning record. When Osriel reaped a world, perfectly eliminating it from existence, the Abaddon could colonize 9 others. His work was vital to Abaddon expansion, and there were even those who believed him to be the most valuable of the judges. When an iteration dies normally, it corrodes, breaking into corrupted fragments that tend to corrupt others and accelerate their own death. With Osriel, that no longer happened. He was the machete the Court of Seven used to beat back the wilderness of chaos, rapidly expanding their holdings. More iterations became habitable than ever before. It was an unprecedented golden age for the influence of the Way, and even Machiel admitted the utility of Osriel's scythe. It was only the man behind the mantle that Machiel didn't trust. Osriel's own objections started to grow louder. If he weren't bound by the Eladari Pact, he could have gone in and saved that world. They had known for centuries that this iteration was going to be corrupted, and he could have cut the cause off at the root. That would itself be a deviation from fate, Machiel argued. In the grand scheme of things, that would lead to an increase in chaos. But manageable, Osriel said. They could keep the deviations under control, which would rarely, if ever, rise to the point of having to destroy an entire world. Unfortunately, while both models had their advantages, neither could be proven conclusively. By the very nature of the problem, there was no looking into the future to see how it would play out. So the two beings most skilled in reading fate continued to argue. Meanwhile, Osriel discovered the restricted records of the Court of Seven regarding the Executor program. This should be his solution, he thought. Raise up people from the iterations, not sworn to the Way, who could interfere without compromising their oaths. But from the records, he could see that it had failed, again and again, Those who fought corruption inevitably became corrupted themselves. So Asriel decided to do some investigation of his own. He traveled to Haven, the prison world of the Abaddon, where he used his authority as a judge to gain access to the Mad King, Daruman, once the greatest of the Abaddon executors. He asked the Mad King what he thought. Why was the executor program flawed? It wasn't the program, Daruman insisted. It was the Abaddon. Being sworn to order made the Abaddon too inflexible, too bound to their own thoughts. Creativity and flexibility were beyond them, and the second that anyone started pushing at the boundaries of their rules, the offending party would be condemned. Asriel promised change. He wanted to revive the executor program, but this time they would be an official division of the Abaddon beneath him. They would be unbound to the Eladari Pact, able to intervene in worlds, and personally selected and supervised by him. They would save worlds by eliminating apocalypses at the root. He would call them Reapers. And if he could get enough support from the Court of Seven to create his own official division, he would even recruit Daruman. Asriel was uniquely able to handle Class One fiends. Daruman and Oth-Kimeth laughed together. Mighty as Asriel may be, as keen as his eyes were, he would never succeed. The Court of Seven could not be convinced, and they would be against him for this. If Asriel was really dedicated to his ideals, as he claimed to be, he should join the Vroshir. They, at least, saved human lives. Asriel brought his proposal before the court, and as expected, there was heavy resistance. Only the new, young Suriel would have allowed it, a woman he had known for centuries by this point as she worked her way up the ranks, and even she had misgivings. Asriel pled his case, but was dismissed. He accepted that. He had looked into the future and seen that this would not be an easy task. He would try again and again, as long as it took. Record complete. Chapter 13. Yeren cycled her last elixir and focused on the layer of red aura around her. The Hydra blood that had caked her robes and splattered on her skin flowed off, leaving her spotless. The same couldn't be said for Zeal and Mercy. Zeal didn't look particularly bothered by the dark spots that covered him and his gray cloak, but Mercy looked like a rat that had been partially drowned in mud. Orthos had simply burned the blood away, but he was clearly unhappy. He snorted as he looked up at the entrance overhead.
How many is that now?
Yeren had been keeping track.
6. Bleed me like a pig if something's not spitting them out.
Every time they killed one, hunger spirits devoured it. They were repurposing the energy, she was sure. She had tried to stop them as much as possible, but the hunger spirits were endless, and her power wasn't. The others were all tired, and she was still carrying the bulk of each battle. But her perception was warning her about what was lurking up above. It felt like the tomb hydras, but much deeper, bigger. It felt like a mother giving birth to each of the dread beasts that fell down. She hoped that wasn't it.
I'm going up, she said reluctantly.
Mercy threw out a hand like she thought Yeren was going to dash away immediately.
No, wait. We agreed we'd stay here. They're going to grind us like grain in a mill. We stay here, and Linden will know exactly where to find our bodies.
It was hard to sense anything here, since her perception couldn't penetrate the walls and everything was soaked in a hunger mantra. But she had still expected to sense Aethon or Linden by now. Something had delayed them. Zeal sighed.
You think it's going to slowly kill us, so you want to dive in all at once. You want it to quickly kill us.
Not us. I'm going myself.
Yeren didn't want to say it out loud, but she felt like she could keep fighting even once her madre was gone. She would be ground down eventually, too, but even if she was left with nothing more than her sword and the strength of her body, she could probably keep fighting for days. If they kept fighting, Aethon and Linden would find 3 bodies and Yeren, and that wasn't acceptable. If Orthos and Mercy died, it would be after Yeren. Zeal, he was mostly a mystery to her. Maybe he could survive without her help.
So, if we get separated, you're leaving us here?
Orthos asked. He took a casual bite out of the Hydra's meat.
Guess so,
she said, but her grip shifted on her sword. That was the only reason she hadn't dashed up the corridor in the ceiling already. If the labyrinth shifted again and sealed her off, she wasn't confident in blasting her way back down. And what if more of these Hydras started funneling into the chamber while she was locked away in some broom closet? Mercy chewed on her lip and looked up, and next to her, Zeal let out another heavy breath.
We don't have much choice, he allowed.
Can you take a look and then come back?
Mercy asked. Yeren eyed the opening in the ceiling. There hadn't been another tomb Hydra yet, but she could feel power gathering above them. She had been keeping an eye on how the labyrinth shifted, though. It seemed like the tunnels closed off at the entrances, not in the middle, or they would have been crushed to paste the first time an entrance shifted while they were still in the hallway.
Better to move quick than wait to die, Yeren muttered.
She sheathed her sword and spread her arms wide.
Come here, everybody. Family hug.
Zeal walked over to her, still dull-eyed as ever. Even Orthos hopped from the ground to land on her shoulder. Mercy's eyes sparkled as she joined, wrapping everyone in an eager hug of her own.
I never thought I'd hear you say those words.
Yeren was a little thrown off at how easily everyone had joined her.
I'm about to carry you.
I know,
Mercy said, squeezing Zeal with one arm and Yeren with the other.
It's still nice.
Yeren held on to everyone and leaped. She had expected to have to walk the others through her plan, but since they seemed to be sharper than she'd expected, she didn't say anything. The second they cleared the inner entrance to the tunnel in the ceiling, Mercy spread out a web of strings of shadow, and Zeal forged a hovering circle of green runes. They landed on his forged platform, and Yeren released everyone. Mercy gave Zeal and Yeren each one more squeeze before she released. Then she patted Orthos on the head. The aura above them was growing stronger, and though the tunnel was long, long enough that Yeren wondered if it extended above ground, she could see the glow of Death Mudra above her.
Seal yourselves off when I'm gone,
Yeren ordered. Zeal had already started forging runes over their heads. Yeren wasn't sure how the platform of Mudra beneath her feet would hold up to a full-powered jump, so she hopped onto the wall and then bounced between the inside of the tunnels as she made her way up. All the time, she had her spiritual perception extended. She regretted it almost immediately. Whatever was in the chamber above her felt nauseating. Like the bleeding phoenix, it had a sense of hunger, corruption, and death. It felt like a ravenous pile of corpses somehow brought to hideous life. Her stomach twisted, but she ran her mudra through her sword. If she had to end up retreating from the labyrinth, ridding the world of a creature like this would have made her trip worthwhile. The higher she got, the more the sensation churned her gut, but she braced herself. She still wasn't prepared when she cleared the upper entrance. Eyes, glowing with the pale green of Death Mudra, glared at her from every direction. The entire chamber was a mass of disgusting flesh, endless as far as her spirit could sense. Motion stirred in the distance, and she spotted another tomb Hydra emerging from a slick, bulbous sack. It wasn't the only thing in here. Dreadbeasts had half-merged into the flesh, melted as this thing fed. And its spiritual presence. It wasn't a dread god. It didn't have the endless sensation of the phoenix or the titan, though its corruption was equal. She would call it a herald, but it felt more like half a dozen heralds stitched together and smeared across the chamber. Its spiritual pressure crashed over her, and she found it hard to take a breath as every eye in the room focused on her. Tendrils of flesh snaked across the entrance to block off her retreat, but Yeren wasn't about to let it get its way. This thing might have been a highly advanced dread beast, but it was full of blood. The final sword was difficult to use in the labyrinth normally because it required aura, and the aura here was all being consumed by hunger. But there was enough blood aura inside this massive body that she wove it together quickly. She couldn't launch the technique down, or she'd risk killing her friends, so she held on to her shining sword as she fell toward the tendrils of dead, animated flesh. Then she twisted sideways, unleashing the beam of concentrated silver-red energy horizontally. It scraped the monster away from the entrance and sliced through its huge body, releasing a huge roar that shook her bones as much as her ears. She continued falling down as the air filled with death mantra. Yeren forced out mantra and soul fire, but the hostile will was as strong as her own. It eroded everything she did, and she realized the wave of green mantra was going to overtake the others. She launched a rippling sword at the green and black barrier Zeal and Mercy had made below her. It cracked on contact, which was enough for her. She landed sword first, piercing her way through. In the instant she crashed into their platform, Yeren saw Orthos, Zeal, and Mercy all staring at her in astonishment. If they hadn't sensed her coming, they would have met her with a barrage of techniques. But none of them could move as fast as she did. With all the strength she could muster, she slammed a foot down on the forged mantra below. The explosion of death above her was still coming, and gravity was too slow. She seized Mercy and Zeal by the front of their robes, scooped Orthos up with her gold sign, and pulled them down. Yeren twisted in the air, kicking off against the wall and shooting down. She was sure she was going to make it. The malicious presence of the room full of flesh was weaker now, and clearly it couldn't follow her. Once they endured this technique, they would be safe. Then she felt another will barge in, the intelligence that ran all throughout the walls. A ravenous, desperate will. Below her, the entrance blurred as the labyrinth shifted again. Linden and Aethon passed through the trap-filled chamber after the constructs had exhausted themselves. The air was still blistering with the aftermath of all the mantra, but it was simple to protect themselves from that. Little Blue gave a long, whining note of complaint, but she wasn't in any danger. "They're still ahead?" Linden asked. It had taken quite a while for the constructs to exhaust themselves, after all.
"The labyrinth still hasn't shifted yet, which suggests it should be very soon."
Aethon frowned, running his fingers along the wall as he ran.
"I will admit, it is strange," he allowed. "The labyrinth doesn't seem to be working against us. I would have expected—"
They were in the hallway as the labyrinth shifted. Far ahead of them, the doorway that led onto a chamber filled with flashing machines closed. Linden felt the overwhelming sensation of space being twisted, though the hallway didn't change. He suddenly realized why void keys were so difficult to use here. Whatever had authority over the labyrinth was using spatial transmission to move all the chambers around. The usual relationship to space had shifted. The entrance reappeared in a moment, and while they were still running down the hall, Linden realized they were about to head upwards. Someone was falling toward them. It was Yeren, and she was dragging Zeal and Mercy along with her. Linden felt Orthos's presence, and the turtle was terrified. Behind them, a massive wave of death mantra followed. Linden and Aethon dashed into the next room, and his brain twisted as he ran horizontally up, and what had a moment before been a vertical wall shifted to become the floor. Yeren shot toward the ground, toward Linden and Aethon, and in the split second it took her to reach the floor, the death mantra following her would billow out and begin to fill the room. Linden thought Aethon would act before him, but to his surprise, Aethon had frozen up the moment they entered the room. He must have seen something through his bloodline power. So Linden was the first to act. His eyes cooled as they turned crystal blue, a reflection of Little Blue's, and he projected pure, cleansing mantra in all directions. The death mantra poured into his hollow domain and wasn't wiped out immediately. It faded as it poured in, like salt poured into a bucket of water. Yeren landed easily next to Linden, the durability of a herald meaning she had no need of a full-body enforcer technique. He would be far more worried about Mercy and Zeal, who hadn't had an easy trip. Then again, Zeal had his body thrice forged in soulfire. He bounced on Yeren's shoulder and then slid off, unfazed by the trip. Mercy staggered as she moved to her feet, grabbing Linden for support. Orthos had stiffened up, and Linden was certain that if his black, pebbly skin could go pale, it would have. The sensation he radiated through their bond was pure, shocked terror.
So much worse, he mumbled. So much worse to be small.
Little Blue gave a sympathetic chime. Yeren blew the lock of red hair out of her face and looked up.
Sliced that one a little thin, didn't he?
Now that I think of it, staying in the hallway so we didn't get separated was stupid, Zeal commented. We should have just gotten lost.
No telling what else we could have run into, Mercy said.
Lyndon let his hollow domain drop. In fact, the entrance into the ceiling had closed almost immediately after the wave of Death Madre had reached them. He called his void key open, once again forcing it open with his will. He had to push more focus and more Madre into it this time. Whether it was the hunger aura or the authority of the labyrinth's owner suppressing spatial artifacts, it was getting worse. He stepped inside, rummaging around for a moment, and pulled out a pill and a sealed case of scales. He handed the pill to Yeren.
You used up a lot of Madre there. Are you okay?
She nudged him with her shoulder before popping the pill in her mouth.
Bright and shiny. Just need to fill my glass back up.
Lyndon did not fail to notice that two of her party were covered in fresh bloodstains. He looked to Mercy for confirmation.
No, we're fine. We almost had to deal with a herald-level striker technique, but Yeren got us out of there.
She released him and shifted from one foot to the other to check her balance.
Harold?
Lyndon thought immediately about the possibility of Regan Shen being in the labyrinth, and he looked up at the ceiling despite himself, though the door had already been blocked. Yeren waved off his concern.
Bigger version of the dead snakes. Just a pile of meat, so not like it's going to chase us. And we'd feel it coming from a mile off. It's...
With a blur, the stone wall on the far end of the chamber fuzzed out of existence. It left a hole into a dark tunnel, which sloped downwards. Lyndon's spirit rang an alarm at the feeling of ancient, overwhelming death that radiated from the tunnel. Yeren looked and sounded like she'd just bitten into a rotten fruit.
It's like that. There it is.
You and I can handle it, if you're ready, Lyndon said. Ethan can come with us. Mercy, can you back us up?
Mercy frowned at her bow.
I think Sue is getting tired, but I can use the binding once or twice more. There's a couple more Archlord hits, but it's not like one herald. It's more like a bunch of heralds smeared over some toast,
Yeren provided. That reminded Lyndon of the eight-man empire, and he turned to ask Ethan if he knew what that might mean about their enemy. When he saw Ethan still standing there, an unreadable expression on his face, Lyndon realized Ethan hadn't said a word since they'd entered the room. It inspired Lyndon himself to look around. There wasn't much to sense in the room, certainly nothing to draw his spiritual perception. There were a few small dream tablets here and there, but by and large the chamber resembled a once crowded workshop or storeroom that had been cleared out in a hurry. Dust covered the floor, along with bits of grit and undefinable scraps of metal. There were scuffs and indentations in the stone where something heavy had been moved, but with the power of these floors, Lyndon would be shocked if any amount of weight would have made a dent on their own. Here and there, bolts remained in the walls where something had been suspended, but whatever it was had been removed long before. High up on the far wall, he saw the thing that must have grabbed Ethan's attention immediately. A giant symbol, a scythe hanging like a crescent moon over the Aurelius family crest. This room had once belonged to the Aurelius family patriarch, Azrael. Lyndon was suddenly much more interested in the dream tablets. Here and there, glittering tablets like cut gemstones were embedded in the wall next to where something must have rested. Lyndon held his hand over one nearby, which hung next to a pale square of wall that looked like it had once held a painting. He slipped his perception into it. The intricately carved ivory box is ringed in script so dense he can barely make it out with his eyes, and it carries a powerful will to bind. The bones used to make it are irreplaceable and come from... Lyndon felt a sudden blinding headache and was kicked out of the memory. He blinked and held on to his head. This was what it had felt like when he tried to view a memory too advanced for him. But that was a shock. What concepts couldn't he handle? He thought he could comprehend most Monarch dream tablets now, but evidently not if it trespassed on certain subjects.
Careful,
Ethan said quietly. He still hadn't moved.
It is only that moment of the tablet that exceeds your authority, Dross mentioned. It should be safe to experience if you pick up a moment after you left off.
Generally speaking, it was hard to view dream tablets with so much precision, which was one reason why they were often attached to projection constructs or control scripts. But with Dross to help, Linden adjusted his entry point and dove back into the tablet.
In a windy forest, his hands open the ivory box. The scripts activate, and he's proud of their efficiency. They are a work of art in the way they synergize with the significance of the bones and of the box itself. The device is now designed for one purpose, and it fulfills that purpose before him now. A powerful suction fills the air, drawing spirits closer. Remnants stumble out of the trees. They have been drawn by the hunger aspects in the Madra, though the hunger doesn't touch him at all. One spirit, a water remnant with minor sword aspects, is the first to fly into the air. It's only about high gold in density, and it resembles a 6-foot praying mantis. At first. In seconds, it folds like paper as it is packed into the box. It sounds disgusting, like meat and bone being crushed and folded, but this device doesn't need to be pleasant to use. Most importantly, the dead matter and binding are perfectly preserved, and the box still has plenty of capacity left.
Linden broke away from the memory. His head still hurt a little from even that momentary thought about the bone. But his thoughts spun as Dross helped him sort out the memories. As with most dream tablets, there were plenty of thoughts behind the memory itself, lending the scene context. Linden could tell how much better this device was at catching and compressing remnants, and how it could wait for centuries with no loss. There had been an idea at the back of the creator's mind. This would be the perfect way to seal a monarch-level remnant. It could even have applications for those attempting to advance to Herald. He expected this to become a much sought-after treasure, and Linden completely agreed. It wasn't as glamorous as a weapon, but he thought Regan Shen would pay the worth of several cities for a soulsmithing tool of this level. Maybe he was the one who had looted this room. He moved to another dream tablet as Yeren was pulled away from it. She had a troubled look on her face.
This is your ancestor, Ethan.
Ethan ran a hand over his head as though wishing for longer hair.
The first of my house, yes.
I'd pick you over him 6 times out of 5.
Ethan blinked.
That may have been the kindest thing anyone has ever said to me. Don't let it swell your head, she muttered. This inspires me to compose a poem. Can I pay you to stop? There once was a man from Iceflower.
Linden reached out for the dream tablet and let the memory overcome him before he had to listen to Ethan's poem.
The enemy is desperate. He's already bloody and beaten, low on Madra, as he has been tormented and kept on the edge of defeat for days now. He raises his axe and swings with a roar, squeezing the last of his Madra and Soulfire into an Echo Forger technique. Phantom axes swing along with them. Osmanthus looks down on him in disdain. There is barely any willpower remaining in this technique. He reaches out with his Madra, pure destruction as befits the Hollow King, and reaches into the Forger technique. With his Soulfire art, he weaves destruction aura as well, drawn from all around him. It takes